Welcome to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. Each week, Jared will speak one-on-one with Department of Defense senior managers discussing policies and programs affecting warfighters and how the military meets its mission. On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And very glad you're with us this week for On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. And before we get too far into the show this week, we want to give a quick programming note. Our schedule is changing starting next week. On DoD is moving an hour later in the afternoon on Wednesdays, so we'll start at 3 p.m. Eastern Time going forward. We're also adding an additional airtime, a couple of them actually, so each week's show will also air at noon on Thursdays and again on Mondays at 9 a.m., right after the Federal Drive here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com. Those housekeeping matters aside, on to our topics for this week. We start our show with a discussion of the Defense Industrial Base. Our guest for the first half of the program is Barry Watts. He's just written a background paper for the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, arguing that, yes, we've been through downturns in defense spending before, but this time around, the nation is at serious risk, he says, of losing the industrial capabilities that have become the leading edge of the way the military operates. He says now it's time for the Pentagon to sketch out a long-term strategy to hang on to the industrial capabilities it needs most to retain military superiority against potential adversaries, and that it can't do that without getting a deeper understanding of what makes the supplier base tick, as incredibly diverse as it is. He tells me DoD has limited resources to prop up critical sections of the industrial base, so it needs to focus on its core competencies, much the way a private business would.
As I said in some of the presentations that we gave on this subject, when Jim Roche became Secretary of the Air Force back in 2001, one of the first things he asked the Air Staff for was, what are the services, what are the Air Force's core competencies? And he got dozens and scores of things in the list that came back. And the point about core competencies being a fairly small number, you know, real genuine core competencies that really give you strategic advantage in the long term over rivals and competitors, is that the list needs to be short enough that you really can focus on them. If you have 73 or 200 top priorities, you really don't have a strategy because you can't devote adequate energy and attention to that many items.
You kind of allude to this idea in the paper, but once you start creating a list that's relatively short of the capabilities you want to protect, the natural response from each of the military departments is going to tend to be, well, hey, wait, everything we do is important, or you missed a bunch of critical stuff here. If DoD were to try to draw up the kind of list that you give as an example here, how would they do it without getting, you know, derailed by that kind of internal fighting?
Well, the point you bring up is why there hasn't been high-level acceptance across the services of any such list. Because inevitably, there'll be pieces of the different services and warfighting communities within those services who will have areas that they think are important. And they may be relatively important in truth, but they're not quite as important as the things we tried to single out as core competencies. You know, think about Honda with engines and powertrains back in the 80s. I mean, they really did kind of focus on those two areas combined with a capability to introduce new products into the market faster than their rivals. So they just got further and further ahead, pretty well vanquished the opposition, the competitors. And over time, those competencies allowed them to move into other markets such as luxury automobiles.
Talk to me a little bit, if you could, about why you think this is kind of a critical time for DoD to start making such a list and start doing some long-term planning around it. You seem to suggest that we're at a point now in this particular downturn where we're really at risk of losing some critical stuff.
Well, I think so. I mean, the budgets are going down. You've got gridlock on Capitol Hill, the sequester, so on and so forth. And on the other end of the problem, I think there's a growing array of military challenges. Anti-access area denial capabilities in the case of China and to a lesser degree in the case of Iran and the Persian Gulf. I think you're looking at the possibility of continued nuclear proliferation. Iran comes to mind in that context. So it's not just the counterinsurgency challenges of Iraq and Afghanistan or the related nation-building aspects of those two particular campaigns. So you got less to do a larger job with, to put it simply. And you know, the real temptation as you go through the annual budget process each year in the building is to simply look across all your programs and capabilities and look for things to cut. And that tends to get done in a fairly non-strategic way, shall we say. So our point of departure for this whole thing has been for a couple of years, you ought to start first with what you really think is important enough to focus attention on, make preferential investments on, give priority to over the long term, because you're really going to need those capabilities. And do that before you get involved in the annual budget cutting drills.
And accepting the premise that you need a relatively short list of priorities that you want to protect, what are the right questions for the department to be asking itself as it tries to make a relatively small list?
Well, you need to sit down, I suppose, and try to think out into the future over the next decade or two and ask yourself questions like, do we really think we can get out of the nuclear business, or are we going to need to maintain a flexible, effective nuclear capability for deterrence, and both direct deterrence of attacks on the United States or its forces, or extended deterrence to that we've extended to allies like South Korea and Japan, and back in Warsaw Pact days to our NATO allies in Europe. Look, it seems to me that we have gone far down the road with long-range precision strike, even in defended airspace or territory, and that's been a capability that we have gotten great effectiveness and value out of over the going all the way back to Desert Storm in 1991. So that, again, is a broad area, long-range precision strike or nuclear forces, that seem to be the kinds of things that you would want to maintain advantage in as long as you could going out into the future. I mean, those are the kinds of questions I think the Defense Department, particularly at the OSD level, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, they ought to be asking those kinds of questions and trying to make some sensible choices.
One of the other points you kind of make is that you really need to understand what is the industrial base, what's in it, all the various complexities that are interwoven together to form this industrial base, which is kind of the reason they launched this sector-by-sector, tier-by-tier review of the industrial base, I think. In your view, has that helped much? Does the department have a better understanding of what the industrial base is, and does that knowledge enable this decision-making process to be a bit more rational one than it otherwise would be?
Well, I don't see how you could develop the kind of strategy that proceeds from what we think is really going to be important, the essential elements of the defense industrial base going out over 10 or 15 or even 20 years, unless you have that kind of in-depth understanding of what our defense industrial base is like. The temptation, the inclination up front of most people is to just think in terms of the really big primes, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, General Dynamics, probably BAE Systems here in the United States. But as in fact came up last week at the event on the Hill, manufacturing and industrial base policy, that particular part of the Pentagon that's been trying to do the sector-by-sector, tier-by-tier analysis, they mentioned one particular supply chain where they went down 19 levels. That suggests a fair amount of complexity.
Yeah.
And Well, what you really want to look for in those kinds of, you identify, all right, here's the five or six or seven areas, core competencies that we think are really important to preserve in the industrial base. And then you start going down the supply chains associated with each of those areas, looking for places where maybe you've got one supplier or one builder, and that company is so strapped for programs that they're getting ready to get out of the business, or they are exiting the business. Those are the kind, unless you do that detailed analysis and develop a real map of the defense industrial base, you're not going to be able to understand where those fragile niches and levels in the supply chains really are.
That is Barry Watts, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. We're talking about mapping a way forward for preserving the parts of the defense industrial base the nation needs most. We'll be back and talk more after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to this week's On DoD. We're talking during this part of the hour with Barry Watts. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments about how DoD preserves critical capabilities in the defense industrial base while budget resources come down. Watts is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's just written a paper on the subject, which he presented on Capitol Hill last week. His central thesis is the Pentagon needs to settle on a relative handful of core capabilities, things that the military does best or that the most important for the nation's defense, and make them a priority when it comes to sustaining the industries it depends on. Once DoD gets to the point where it can say, okay, these are the things that we think are A, critical, and B, at risk, does it have the tools that it needs to intervene and keep those capabilities from atrophying or disappearing?
Well, they do have some tools. They do have some ways of funding a little more in this particular area with a critical company or two if they wish. The best solution would be new starts and major programs that would really bring resources into the areas that they wanted to preserve. But that gets into very complicated interactions with the services and with Congress as well. And, you have all the defense and federal acquisition regulations and so on top of all that. And if the truth be known, an acquisition system that's very, very complex.
Yeah, and a budget process that, as you just kind of said, doesn't allow new starts for at least the first half of the fiscal year every year over and over again, it seems like. We probably don't have time here to go into the rationale that you use behind all six of the military competitions and critical areas of the industrial base that you mentioned in the paper, but can you take us through them rather briefly, just so folks can get an idea of where you're headed and the thought process you use to put together your list?
Well, we started with precision strike. In the industrial base itself, we didn't mention the infrastructure for nuclear forces. And that wasn't mentioned simply because I think we've neglected that area, so it's less obvious that it really is a core competency as opposed to an area of weakness these days. We depend the sort of precision-centric operations that the U.S. military, all the services have gravitated to over the last decade or so, are critically dependent on satellite communications, on a wide range of intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance platforms of one sort or another. Those can be on the ground, in the air, even in low Earth orbit. That's why we sort of focused a bit on access to these global commons like space and cyberspace. Clearly, those get you a fair ways down the road, those particular items, in terms of beginning to identify some areas of core competencies that you'd really want to preserve in the long term. you know, that in short is indicative of the list that we got to. Now, of course, there are things like systems integration and architecture network integration, which are sort of higher-level integrative capabilities that the industrial base, the U.S. industrial base, I believe, has. And those would clearly be the kinds of things you'd want to preserve in the long term. And that kind of takes you to questions like design teams for major systems and whether you've got two or three suppliers or, for example, only one. In the case of the design of nuclear submarines, we're pretty much down to one source right now. And while I believe that particular source has been working very hard to be innovative and control costs in recent years, there isn't a lot of competition, per se, when you've only got one supplier.
Mm-hmm. So after rolling this paper out in a public event last week, where I think you had some interaction with folks from the Manufacturing Industrial Base Policy Office there, do you have a sense of to what extent you and the department leadership in that area are on the same page? Do they feel the need, and are they moving aggressively to identify these priorities in the way that you suggest they should?
Well, I don't know how aggressively they're moving in that direction. I think there has been some agreement that the approach we suggested is probably a sensible idea. If now that sets aside something that I tried to stress in the events last week, which is this is a fairly complicated issue. You know, when you start thinking about how complicated and the global aspects of our defense industrial base tend to be, this is not an easy problem where you can sit down with your calculator or spreadsheet a couple of evenings and figure out exactly what all you want to do. And moreover, it's a dynamic kind of an issue. In other words, some of the fragile niches today may not be the ones that you'll be looking at in 5 years from now. So it's the kind of thing that's clearly an iterative process. And the only question would be whether or not the Defense Department can muster the energy and resources to pay attention to these issues over an extended period of time. In other words, it's not just sitting down and saying, all right, this is our long-term strategy for focusing on what's really important, and here's what we think is really important, and you publish the paper and that's it, and you don't have to do any more thinking or work or continuing to follow what's going on in the industry.
It's a really good point. So do you have any advice on how to create that agile process that's on top of what's fragile at any given second, rather than just having only a long-term view? I mean, what does that require? Close interactions with individual firms? How do you keep your finger on that pulse?
Well, it would be nice if you had real partnerships with industry, between the government and industry. There have been times when that tended to be seen as a rather adversarial relationship. You know, the perception that the companies are greedy, profit-seeking organizations who will try to bilk the poor taxpayer and the government out of as much as they can. Having been in industry, that's not generally my impression of what people on the industry side of the divide between government and the defense industrial base. I just don't think that's the general view. A lot of the people involved have been in the military or been in government, and they're genuinely committed to trying to do the best for the security of the country that they can. But, you know, at the same time, these are for-profit companies, and if the profits go away over a long enough period of time, they're going to exit the business. I think there is one other point that's worth making. If you raise the question of what do you think industry CEOs, particularly the major primes and major contractors, worry about when they get ready to go to sleep at night, one of the virtues of the strategy that we suggested of really trying to focus on what the government, what the Defense Department thinks the real core competencies are from a military competition standpoint, and hence point to corresponding core competencies in the defense industrial base. If you could get some consensus out of the Pentagon on the answers to those questions, on what's really important, I think it would make many of the CEOs go to sleep much more comfortably going forward. Because one of the things you hear from people in industry is, you know, we'll do whatever the government wants if they'll just tell us.
Right.
And the absence of something along the lines, for example, of trying to figure out what the real core competencies going forward might be for the industrial base, that's people in industry just don't see that, by and large, today. And if you could get some progress in that direction, I think it would help both sides.
Well, one follow-up then, is there a clear venue in your mind for that consensus to form? I mean, should it be happening in the lead-up to the next QDR? Does there need to be some direct leadership by the Secretary of Defense himself?
Well, you've got a Undersecretary of Defense for AT&L who certainly would be a key player. If you don't get some buy-in at the Secretary of Defense's level, my guess would be this won't really go anywhere. But with some buy-in at, you know, at the level of the secretary and the deputy secretary and the head of AT&L, an entity like Manufacturing Industrial Base Policy could expect to get the sustained support over time that would be necessary to really begin to implement a strategy focused on deciding what's really important and making sure you preserve those industrial capabilities in the long term.
Barry Watts is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. We'll post a link to his new paper, Sustaining the U.S. Industrial Base as a Strategic Asset, at federalnewsradio.com. At the very top of the show this week, you heard him mention Jim Roche, the former Secretary of the Air Force, and the trouble he ran into as a new secretary a decade ago when he asked the uniformed leaders to talk about the Air Force's core competencies. As a matter of sheer coincidence, Roche just talked about some of those experiences in some somewhat controversial remarks about management of the Air Force. That was before the Air Force Association's annual convention that just happened here in the D.C. area. We'll hear those comments when we come back. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Servin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. This is on DOD. We'll switch gears now from the Defense Industrial Base to the management of the U.S. Air Force. We're going to spend our remaining minutes listening back to a panel discussion from last week at the annual Air Force Association Conference. It's a massive conference every year, obviously, that covers a lot of ground, but I wanted to play back some key sections of this particular event for a couple reasons. A, it was an interesting panel. And B, because one of the panelists was mentioned by our first guest at the top of the show. So we'll start with James Roche, one of the former secretaries of the Air Force. Three of them were on the panel talking about how to manage that service.
I'm going to take the subject on a bit more of an academic note. And I've warned everybody, and I should warn Janet as well, that you need not acknowledge that you know me after today. I worked for Sam Nunn and for Scoop Jackson, both of whom were asked on a number of occasions to be the Secretary of Defense. And they turned it down each time. And they had the same reason, and it was that the place is unmanageable. And they meant that seriously, that someone would go there and be frustrated trying to do things and they couldn't. So I spent a lot of time thinking, well, why is it? And first of all, it's very, very large. Even just take the Air Force down. It's still very, very large. And so moving in a different direction is very difficult as compared to a company. And in the case of a company, you might have a tenure of an executive that's quite a good long time, at a minimum of 10 years. In the case of Northrop at one point, it was when Tom Jones was 37, he became the CEO, and when he was 74, he left. So that was a long time to do things. The more that you have a turnover of leadership, the more difficult it is to have anything stay consistent. Witt and I and Mike Ryan and John Jumper, we tried something which is different, which is to sit down and say, okay, what is it that you feel you should have done that you didn't get done? And we will pick those up. And, of course, both Witt and Mike very nicely told us, well, the Air Force Academy and tankers. Now, you can read the story of both of those in either John's back or my back, but we did do what I wanted to do, which was to build on the work that was done before. In the case of the F-22, Mike Wynn certainly did the same thing with me. But we don't always do that. You know, a new broom comes along and wants to sweep clean, and it undoes things. And it doesn't do things like, if I saw something that Witt had done, I could call Witt and say, why did you do it? That ceased to happen. I put in certain things, and along comes one of the deputy chiefs of staff, and he just arbitrarily changes it. And nobody above him says, wait a minute, why did it get there in the first place? It's a fault of leadership in the Air Force that seems to show up more there than it does, say, in the Navy, where people are closer. No one chief of staff or secretary can really implement great change. And I think that's why Mike has defaulted back to set objectives and things and basically get out of the way. But you can't get out of the way. The job won't let you get out of the way. But what you can do is to try to build on something, even if it's across parties. I mean, Witt was in the Democratic administration, I came to the Republican administration. That we were friends already and that we were both Democrats, you know, was irrelevant. It was, he was my predecessor, he had walked in the shoes, I could talk to him. Mike would speak with me. And that's something we should work on. Chiefs of staff do that as well. You don't have to build a resume at that rank. So you might as well, if you can move it along, do so. Mike Ryan characterized as follows. He says, look, the name of the game is to take the football down the field as far as you can. And by the time they get you on the ground, you're exhausted. And you hand the ball off to your successor. And he tries to take it down, or she tries to take it down a little bit further. And I still think that's quite good. There's certain things you can do. You can work in the whole acquisition world, procurement world, and get on with it. But you have to realize that sometimes the change in leadership in the uniform part has changed how people do things. The B-2 is my best example. The B-2 was done in not by the Congress. It was certainly despised by the newspapers because it was a bomber. It was done in by U.S. Air Force officers. I know the details. I know the day the secretary was out in the West Coast, and the chief of staff went down to see my friend Dick Cheney and basically said, you know, we don't want that thing. And once that happened, it was impossible to ever fix it. That's bad. That's very, very bad when that happens. So, this notion of trying to actually succeed on your predecessors would go a long way to having a couple of themes that you could just press on. I just spoke with Mike Gould, and he was very good at the Air Force Academy for doing just that. He picked up on the stuff JR had done and tried to move it forward, made some change, which makes great sense. And he and Paula just worked to make this better. And you notice it's the one academy. Thanks, Scott. There's no problems yet, but every 4 years, everything changes. So when I would talk to young executives on subjects of how you manage things like this, I'd ask them to consider the following questions. Think of this, you're in a company. Would you buy the company? Would you go out and raise the money and buy this company? And they always think about it. If they said no, you'd say, well, then why, what's wrong, et cetera. But typically they'd say, yeah. I'd say, okay, if you bought it, would you run it just the way we're running it? That was the pregnant question. And they invariably go, no. I say, well, why don't you fix it? What is it? Why don't we hear about it? The process of continual process improvement has to be there. You can't allow a situation where the leadership can't make the sorts of strategic changes you want to make, other than combining material command and systems command. You've got to have something that says, change is good. Let's figure out what's the best thing. Let's adapt. If you don't adapt, the place calcifies. And the people who are there the longest, quite often the civil servants wind up being the real leaders. This happened in acquisition, when for 10 years there was no assistant secretary of acquisition. The power devolved to a civilian and caused a problem. The Air Force today has not had an assistant secretary of the Air Force for over 8 years. Over 8 years. Because no one will come touch it given the troubles. So, once in Northrop, I did something very interesting. I hired a group. I don't want to tell you the names of the consultants that come running for business from you, to play the role of T. Boone Pickens and do a raid on Northrop. So give you access to everything. Just tell me, what would you do, why would you do it, et cetera. They did, and then we went through and said, okay, all those things you would fix to get healthy, to pay the premium, we're going to do now. And I once told T. Boone about this, and he's a man of business. He said, well, where was my cut? So I'm going to make 2 points that over time I have thought about, I've observed, and I feel somewhat strongly about. There are two areas where I believe what has happened with this model, which is the World War II, post-World War II model, not much different than the other services, slightly different than the Navy, of what's happening is that the line, the concept of line, is so strong in the Navy it cures a lot of ills. It's not strong in the Air Force. It really is not. A good thing to keep in mind when you're a naval officer is there was once back in the days when ships used to anchor at Newport Island, get on a launch. Launch had an accident. Some people were hurt badly. And they went to look for accountability. There had been a commander on the launch and a Lieutenant JG. And the Lieutenant JG was court-martialed. Now, Witt knows why. The commander was a lawyer. And since the law is only someone who may succeed to command can be in charge of any vessel. That notion you learn so early that you get on a launch, especially if you're sitting close, and you go look at people's face and you go up and ask them, you know, what's your rank, what's your data rank, blah, 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 to find out, am I going to be in hack for this thing that's got 80 people on it, or is this person? So the notion of command, we don't honor command as we should in the Air Force. And what I think has happened is some of the supporting systems for the Air Force forget that notion of command, which in something like the Navy is everything. So my first group that I would want to turn to and say, hey, guys, would you take a good look at yourselves and start over, is the AQ world. And a lot of the AQ problems are coming from OSD. They have driven up costs. I just saw a chart recently of sort of overtime cost overruns. It goes like this, and then it goes like that. What's different? The A5000 series of instructions, which had all of these supervisors, 5,000 of them. And I've been in DABs where a very senior person said, well, we have to stop the 22 program because it's got a major problem. And I turned with my usual warmth and said, what do you mean? He says, canopy howl. And I said, you bleep, bleep idiot. Have you ever bought a car that has a wind noise? You don't cancel the car, you fix it. But no sense of what the standing army costs. So they'll throw a delay in, and it means nothing to them. It's a little bureaucratic victory to the program. It's brutal. It's also within our Air Force, not the right attitude. And, Janet, I hope you work on it. And here's the example. John and I were once in Bagram. We had done some innovation and put a terabyte server in a Global Hawk, which would hold historic information. Special Forces people started to make use of it and found that they could get information from the Global Hawk matched against what was stored in the terabyte server. So I said, I would approach to the village every 8 minutes. 8 minutes, they had every point of ingress and egress covered and updated. And so you go to Bagram, you go in a tent, then you go in another tent, and you go to the tent within the tent to meet with them on their plywood tables. And they just said, please, can you keep this up? And we said, yes. I so directed. John so directed. Equipment was shipped to El Dafra, and the PEO refused to put it on the plane because he didn't like the performance of Northrop by Global Hawk. But he didn't tell anyone. Now, in an organization where the line officers are the key to the service, that person would have been finished. Was not finished. Nothing was done about it. Both John and I found about it after we had left the Air Force. So that sort of attitude towards the person who you might call the user, the customer, or whatever, needs to be emphasized all of the time. And in fact, those of us who have been in business know that the key to a program cost control is schedule. Schedule is everything, just like cash is king, schedule. Anybody who screws with the schedule, you have to stop them, get your things on. My second group, and Johnny should feel good because you're only a B-level target. This other is A-level target, and that's the personnel system of the Air Force. It's bad. It's a historic hangover, and it's got itself all kinds of problems. Officer development is terrible. There was another panel about we still can't provide people for major joint positions because we don't prepare anybody. We have a situation where there's no sensible strategy of what do we want from our line officers especially. Well, we want them to fly. Well, it turns out they get into very responsible positions. They should be able to do more than just fly. We've had a very poor education model. Very good for enlisted, very poor for officers. The correspondence course takes important people's time in those moments where they could be with their families and gives them something that's basically worthless. As John pointed out when I went after this, he said he never has visited the place he got his master's degree from. And I said, well, how many double E's do we get from this program? How many aero engineers go through this program? How many systems engineers go through it? Zero. In terms of the program we set up, Mike continued it, the systems engineering course and department at the Air Force Academy. Drew some very good cadets into it. One of whom was so good, he was sent to MIT, did his dissertation, which is, I commend to you, General. It's basically one of his points is sometimes the acquisition community can do more harm than good. This young fellow did a very thorough job, and it's academic, but it's very, very good. And when he saw me, he came to tell me about it, and I said, that's great. He says, yeah, but there's bad news. The personnel system has ended the program. I thought to myself, ended the program in systems engineering? Hello? Am I not hearing right? It's stupid, blatantly stupid. But there's no line control of the personnel system, none whatsoever, and it causes all kinds of problems.
That's Jim Roche, a former Secretary of the Air Force, talking about his experience managing that service and some of the problems he believes it still faces. When we come back, we'll hear thoughts in a similar vein from another former Secretary, Whitten Peters. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serving. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. We'll wind up this week's show with a few more thoughts on management of the Air Force. We're spending the second half of the program this week listening back to a panel discussion from the Air Force Association's annual convention last week. You heard in the last segment from Jim Roche, a former Secretary of the Air Force, speaking on a panel along with two other former secretaries. We'll hear now from Whitten Peters, who also served as Secretary of the Air Force in the early 2000s.
When I arrived, Ron Fogelman had resigned somewhat abruptly. Mike Ryan appeared 2 weeks before I did, and I think the two of us were looking for the washrooms when we got there, even though Mike had the benefit of having a father who was chief of staff of the Air Force. And so I had time to think about this the other day. I had dinner with Debbie James, whose hearing is tomorrow, to give her unsolicited advice and some solicited advice. And let me tell you a little bit what my thoughts. First, I said the first principle is never follow Mark Welsh on a stage. That's the first principle. And second, near and dear to Mike Wynn, don't trip over the nuclear mission. Nobody will pay for it, but everybody says it's important. So from my standpoint, maybe because I'm a lawyer and was briefly in the U.S. Navy in as a line officer but in an intelligence billet, my sense about how bureaucracies work and about how Washington works is that you basically get what you negotiate. You know, for many years, there was in every airline magazine that you'd read, if you read, you know, flew commercial, there was a guy named Charlie Karras who taught negotiation, and his line was always, in life, you get what you negotiate. And I think that's largely true. I mean, the idea that there is a chain of command is interesting, but I think it's largely irrelevant. I would say that one of the nice things about the way the Air Force works is you have 700,000 people who are basically competent, basically smart, and basically understand what people expect of them. But it's what people expected of them, you know, with the last chief and secretary or the chief and the secretary before that, And, you know, the good part of that is the Air Force is largely runs itself. So if you don't do anything, it's not terrible. But as times change, it's going to keep on a course, something like, you know, Jim Roach's beloved ship. You know, it's not going to change direction unless something really happens. So when I arrived and Mike Ryan arrived, we decided that, you know, we had a serious problem. We were losing senior NCOs faster than we could replace them, and we needed to do something about it. And the standard stuff had not worked. Your money had not worked. Back in those days, people were not as well paid, so money should have worked, but it really was not doing the trick. So he and I had the luxury of being able to turn to a lot of very smart people. And, you know, the nice thing about the Air Force is you can go to someone like Eric Benkin, who was my chief master sergeant of the Air Force at that time, and say, Eric, why are people leaving? You know, and he would know because he and his wife had been through all the enlisted ranks and for years. They were out with the people, and they would know the answer to that. It was because, as we used to say, you recruit the individual, but you retain the family, and the families were really unhappy. And that wasn't being affected at all by money. I mean, money was nice, but it wasn't enough money to deal with the family disruption. And the other thing you could do is you could turn to your senior officers and your wing commanders and wing kings, folks like that, and ask them why are people leaving. The nice thing is they actually know as well, and they often feel helpless to do anything about it, but they have lots of good ideas. So once you do some listening, you can often kind of figure out what makes sense and what you have to do. And then, to me, the problem is the persuading. You know, a lot of the Air Force will go on and, you know, no matter what you do. Pilots will be trained. People will be recruited. A lot of that stuff you don't need to worry about. But you do need to worry about losing your people faster than you can replace them. That's not a good situation. So we came up with the idea of the AEF with a lot of help from a lot of people. AEF had been around in the mobility side for a long time. And it really was an idea that was percolating around among a lot of colonels and BGs and major generals and who felt that it was a great idea and nobody was listening to them. But, you know, Mike Ryan and I, not having anybody really to talk to, actually did listen to them and thought that was a good idea, and we changed it. But then you have to sell it. You have to sell it. And to me, that's one thing that Air Force senior leadership has not always done well, and particularly on Capitol Hill, but also, I think, within the ranks. And I really praise Mark Welsh for what he is doing and trying to explain to people why they're important, why they're here, and how they fit into an organization. Because I think that's really key to getting people to move in any direction you want to move them. And I think that's really been part of the Air Force's problem, is why do we have an Air Force? How do you answer that question persuasively? How do you tell, you know, Airman Snuffy, like Seaman Snuffy that I used to deal with every day, you know, why it's important that he or she comes to work every day and do what they do? And I think, you know, the current chief has really worked very hard on that with his videos and his pictures. I mean, that's really a key issue. And that's what I actually talked with Debbie James about, is it seems to me that, you know, if you want to do anything in this Air Force, one of the things you have to do is you have to persuade people to go with you. And in the case of Mike Ryan and I, we got the 4 stars or their deputies to come into Washington about every 6 weeks on average and sat down and met with us. I still remember being at AFA in Orlando after I had stepped down, and Jim, you were not there yet, I don't think. And I'm sitting in the front row with Mike Ryan, and John Jumper talks, and everybody else kind of goes through the line, and Jumper, you know, he comes down and sits down, and I say, John, that was terrific. And Mike Ryan says, yeah, we got them all talking in the same way. That's really great. And that's, you know, I think that really is important. To talk to a couple of things that Jim said, I've got to say the acquisition system is incredibly frustrating. I am somebody who participates in that system by overturning contract awards, which is remarkably easy to do. And you just kind of wonder, you know, what were people thinking? I also am part of the problem because I was on the Section 800 committee in 1989 when we took 2 years and came up with the background that became FARA and FASA. And we killed a lot of statutes. And unfortunately, that probably needs to be done again. It's not just statutes, it's regulations. And frankly, it's the idea that everything has to be made here in the Pentagon. My sense is that that's been made worse by the fact that there's now this joint overlay so that the JROC doesn't have to worry about costs and nobody else has to worry about requirements. It's kind of the way it works out. So you end up with requirements that aren't necessarily great. And, oh, by the way, you have to predict what a fighter jet's going to do 25 years from now because that's when you're going to get it. And, you know, the requirements are therefore laid on in a way that is, you know, virtually impossible. And then the testers come along and they say things to you like, well, if we shoot a cannon through the wing, it's not going to fly. And the answer is, well, that's right, but it's going to be at 75,000 feet, and the cannons just don't work very well up there. Yeah, but We're going to have to tell Congress it's operationally ineffective. And I could still laugh after Snake Clark and Mike Ryan and John Jumper and everybody else worked on the Predator. Get it out in the field and it's actually killing people. In comes the report from the testers that it's operationally ineffective.
It doesn't work.
And having witnessed it work with my bare eyes, with my own eyes, I just find that just unacceptable. But I don't know what you can do about acquisition. Maybe it needs to be more line-driven. Maybe we just need to wake up someday and get rid of the 5,000 series. Maybe we just need to shake people. But it is just not working, and it's just too much supervision and not enough actually doing anything.
That's Whitten Peters, a former Secretary of the Air Force, speaking alongside two other former secretaries on a panel at the Air Force Association's annual convention here in Washington last week. The other two panelists were Jim Roche, former secretary, and our apologies to Mike Wynn, another former secretary. We couldn't get to his comments just because of time constraints this week. That is going to do it for this week's program for On DoD This Week. Very glad you could join us. Do want to mention one more time, if you missed the top of the show, we are switching schedules effective with next week's program. We'll be moving to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays for our first weekly airing. Also going to play back the show a couple more times during the course of the week to give folks more of a chance to hear it if they miss it during that first airing. So it will air again on Thursdays at noon and again the following Monday at 9 o'clock right after the Federal Drive here on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com. That's it for now. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.